We'll hear arguments first this morning in Thomas against the Superintendent of the Ohio Reformatory for Women. Mr. Stanley, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the Court, if it pleases the Court, ladies and gentlemen in the audience, it's an honor to appear before the Court. I understand from the clerk that this is the 50th anniversary of the very first argument in this building, so I'm doubly honored that I am appearing before the Court. I would first express what I would consider my mea culpa. I wish that I had filed objections in this case. It would have prevented having to come up to the Supreme Court for a decision in this case. It would have prevented a lot of time from having to be expounded on this case. However, I didn't, and I think that given the case law involved from this court and the circuits, that it wasn't necessary, and I would like to proceed with the argument. A little history of the case. My client was charged with murder in Cuyahoga County in Cleveland. She was convicted. On appeal, Judge Krenzer, who is now a federal district court judge in Cleveland, held that from the current psychological and sociological research has emerged a profile of a battered woman as one who displays unique behavioral patterns and psychological characteristics, as well as differences in reaction and perception, all of which are not within the knowledge of the average juror. He concluded that without expert testimony on a battered woman syndrome, a jury would be unable to have a sufficient comprehension of the defendant's state of mind at the time of the homicide. The Ohio Supreme Court granted a review of the case and reversed the reversal. I then went to the federal district court judge in Cleveland. It was referred to a magistrate who recommended that the petition for habeas corpus be denied. The district court judge did a de novo determination, notwithstanding the failure to file objections. The Sixth Circuit, implementing what's now known as the Walters policy, held that by failing to object to the magistrate's report, one waives the right to appeal to the circuit from the district court order. I then petitioned for cert, and this court granted it. There are basically four points I'd like to make an argument today. The first and most important one is the interplay between the Magistrates Act and Article 3 of the United States Constitution. When our forefathers were setting up the new government after the Revolutionary War, they were very wary of putting all of the governmental power, basically the legislative, executive, and judiciary, into the same hands. Accordingly, they felt that it was necessary that there be an independent judiciary. They wrote Article 3. Article 3 basically says that there shall be a Supreme Court and such inferior courts as Congress may establish. It also said that those courts were to be staffed by judges who have life tenure and a set salary. I must admit that Article 3, at first blush, seems a relatively simple statement of fact. It spawned a great deal of litigation in this court. I do not pretend to understand Article 3 and the litigation that it spawned, particularly in such cases as Northern Pipeline. However, with regard to the interplay between Article 3 and the Magistrates Act, this court has quite clearly stated what the law is. Now, the Magistrates Act was provided in Congress in 1976 and subsequently amended, basically, to set up a series of inferior judicial officers, inferior, that is, to the district courts, to help the district courts with the overwhelming case law that they were being presented with. They may consider non-dispositive pretrial matters, conduct evidentiary hearings of dispositive motions, habeas corpus, etc. In the section that we're dealing with here, that is 28 U.S.C. 636b1b, they can conduct hearings on a habeas corpus provide the judge with proposed findings of fact and recommendations for disposition by the judge. The parties may file objections, and the judge shall make a de novo determination of those portions of the report objected to. However, the last sentence, I think, is the key. The court may accept, reject, or modify the report. This court, in several cases, has considered the interplay between Article 3 and the Magistrates Act, most often through the pen of Chief Justice Berger. The basic cases are the United States versus Raddatz and Matthews versus Weber. This court quite clearly has said the Magistrates Act is constitutional because the ultimate decision-making is rests with the United States District Court. Those cases basically came up for 3 points. One, in going over the legislative history of the Magistrates Act, this Court has said Congress was sensitive to the Article III considerations. They were sensitive to not putting in a magistrate Article III duties. Hence, this Court stressed and Congress stressed that the ultimate adjudicatory determination was reserved to the District Court. Second point this Court has made in Raddatz and Matthews is the Court says that the ultimate authority and responsibility to make an informed formal determination must remain with the judge. Three, the Court stressed the magistrate's role is one of helping the Court to narrow the dispute, focusing on the legal issues. However, it again stressed, the Court alone remains the ultimate decision maker. In sum, this Court said in Raddatz and Weber, the delegation of the magistrate to hear issues does not violate Article III so long as the ultimate decision is made by the District Court.
Mr. Stanley, did you receive notice of the waiver rule?
Yes.
You were requested to file objections within 10 days?
In the printed portion of the magistrate's report at the very end contained what I now recognize to be notice that if I don't file objections, there would be a waiver.
Did the District Court give you an extension of time within which to file objections?
Yes, they did.
Did you file any?
No, I did not.
How much additional time did he give you?
Two
or three months?
Whatever the time, I don't remember.
How would the District Court ever know that you objected if you failed to file any objections?
First of all, if I may say, the issues were fully briefed. When I filed the petition for habeas corpus, I included with it a memorandum of law concerning the issues I wished to raise. It was approximately 20 pages long. In my opinion, this Court's decisions in Raddatz and Weber mandate a independent judicial review of the magistrate's report by a district court.
On its own initiative?
No, on the initiative of what is included in 626B1B. That is, failure to object, the penalty for failure to object as enunciated by Congress is no de novo determination. The Court may accept, reject, or modify the report of the magistrate. It seems that this Court has quite clearly said the Court must be the ultimate decision maker. Otherwise, you have a situation where the magistrate ends up being an Article III judge. For instance, in the sixth...
Mr. Stanley, if you filed objection, would you be here now?
Well, probably not, but hopefully I would have won down there and you
all
would have accepted it anyway.
All of this is brought about by you failing to file a piece of paper.
That's correct.
And that's what we used our time up for.
Pardon?
That's what we are using our time up for.
Well, Your Honor, I believe it's a much more serious matter than that. Here we have Raddatz and Weber requiring a district court judge to make a final determination. The Walters policy, as enunciated by the Sixth Circuit and other circuits in their policies, have stated that the district court doesn't really even have to consider the case if you don't file objections. That raises a magistrate to the ultimate decision-maker in a case.
But, Mr. Stanley, if you're right that Raddatz and the other case stand for the proposition that the district court is an independent adjudicator, the adoption of your view would really allow counsel losing before the magistrate to simply go directly to the Court of Appeals without even paying any attention to the district court.
Well, I disagree with you, Justice Rehnquist. First of all, a magistrate's report is not a final appealable order. Congress, in writing the statute, says if there are no objections, the district court doesn't have to make a de novo review, but the district court still must consider the case. It must be the ultimate decision maker. The district court then, making an independent review, but with the magistrate having focused the issues, spends much less time on the case, makes a determination, and that is from that.
But the district court would surely be even more focused if it had the benefit of objections to the magistrate's report from the losing party.
I'm not going to disagree with you, Your Honor. However, it seems to me, for instance, in this case, where I had filed a 20-page brief, the issues were before the court. It was an issue of law. This is the sixth court that my client has been to, that I have been to her on her behalf. To say that there's a waiver of anything is, in my opinion, untenable.
I raised the issue, I briefed the issue, the magistrate came to a different conclusion. All the district court judge had to do is read, and in fact, what he did do, because he did conduct a de novo determination anyway, what he did do was read my brief, read the magistrate's report, come to a conclusion.
Well, in this instance, how was Article 3 violated? Because by your own statement, the district court did give review to the magistrate's finding here, and the finding became the district court finding. Now, if you make no objections in a district court, if the proceedings at trial had been in the district court initially, a court of appeals is not going to consider things that aren't raised at the district court level. Why should it be different with a magistrate's report that's considered by the district court?
Well, Justice O'Connor, if one reads the opinions in the circuits, there's only one circuit, the Fourth, which discusses this issue in terms of procedural default. The Sixth Circuit does not talk in terms of procedural default. The Sixth Circuit says specifically, you waive your right to appeal, period. Now, in a procedural default, you're not waiving your right to appeal. You still have the right to appeal, but the circuit court says you didn't preserve it below. It seems to me
the effect is the same, and either event the Court of Appeals wouldn't be hearing it. Isn't that right?
That's correct. But it seems to me in a situation like this, it's a question of form over substance, where you have, number one, a brief on the issue, the matters that are in issue before the court on behalf of the petitioner and the magistrate's report. You have a right by, as enunciated by Congress, to appeal from the denial of a habeas corpus. That is an independent right that Congress has seen fit to give to a petitioner in a habeas corpus proceeding. I don't know that a court can say we're going to ignore Congress and we're going to impose this penalty. Further,
well, Mr. Stanley, did I understand you to say that the recommendation of the magistrate to which you did not object was nevertheless the subject of de novo review by the district judge?
That's correct.
And was the judgment that the district judge entered reflect that determination on that issue?
The judgment of the district court reflects that there was a
Did it reflect the determination of the issue, the subject of a recommendation by the magistrate to which you did not object?
That's correct.
And you didn't agree with that, the judgment in that respect?
From the district court, no, I did not.
And is that what you wanted to have reviewed in the Court of Appeals?
That's correct. I filed a notice from the judgment entry of the district court, notice of appeal to the Sixth Circuit.
Whether the district court purported to review the report de novo or not, the only time that you get an appealable judgment is when the district judge enters an order.
That's correct.
So in any case, it's going to be a district court judgment.
That's correct.
And what do you say? Why does that raise a problem under Article 3?
Well, to be honest with you, Judge, as you pointed out in your dissent in Northern Pipeline, I'm not convinced that I know what
Article 3 is. You're taking a lot of your time on this Article 3 issue.
Well,
you've got something else going, haven't you?
Yes, Your Honor. Only because Article 3, in interpreting the Magistrates Act, has said the reason that it's constitutional is that the decision-maker must be the district court.
Well, it always is.
That's correct. Since the district court must review the magistrate's report, whether objections are filed or not, it seems to me that the Walters policy and the other circuits are wrong when they say that there's a waiver of the right to appeal. Because
you've consumed 17 minutes now on this point. If you want to save some time for the other one, you'd better get on to it.
I must say that if you're right, then even if Congress said you either object or you waive, that would be unconstitutional.
I would agree with you.
Yeah.
A second point that I wish to make in my remaining 13 minutes.
May I ask one question before you go to your second point? Do you understand the Sixth Circuit rule to be that they think the statute compels a waiver, or that as a matter of practice in the Sixth Circuit we will enforce a waiver rule?
Well, they're writing, the language that they said was, although may file objections is something that you may or may not do, they felt that under the supervisory power, they could force this issue by making it a rule in the Sixth Circuit. One of the dangers of that, in my opinion, Justice Stevens, is the fact that different circuits have different rules for jurisdiction. And if we go to what was going to be my third point, which is that the courts cannot limit their own jurisdiction that Congress has given them. In different circuits, some people can appeal. In four of the circuits, you can appeal no matter what the magistrate does, whether or not you file objections or not, you can appeal from the denial of a habeas. In the Sixth Circuit, you cannot appeal from the denial if you do not file objections. In one of the circuits, they talk about procedural default. In one of the circuits, the Eighth Circuit rejects the waiver theory. So you have differing jurisdictions of the Court of Appeals as a result from these differing policies with regard to whether or not you file objections.
Well, there may not be a difference after this case is decided.
Hopefully not. My second argument is a due process argument that, as it was enunciated in United States versus Raddatz by the Chief Justice, which basically says that what due process you're entitled to is appropriate to the nature of the case. Citing Matthews versus Aldridge, it goes into the question of private interests, the risk of erroneous determination by reason of the process accorded, and the public interest in administrative burdens. It seems to me that when we're talking about the great petition of habeas corpus, and where Congress has required the right to appeal, has given you that right, that due process requires in habeas corpus that the ultimate decision-making be with the district court and that the right to appeal be given to a petitioner. I've already mentioned in reference to Justice Stevens' argument my third point, which is that I do not believe that the courts can limit their own jurisdiction. I would say that in summation that Walters is wrong because it limits their jurisdiction. Congress never said in its statute that a failure to object is a waiver. There already exists a penalty for failure to object, which is you do not get a de novo determination. The statute says if there are objections, there shall be de novo determination. That is the penalty for failure to object, not waiver of the right to appeal.
You do not get one, but do you argue that the judge may nevertheless give one?
No, I believe the judge may give. In fact, if the court can do whatever it decides to do. As Chief Justice said in Raddatz and Weber, the magistrate is there to help the district court in its overburdened caseload. It's there to focus the issues. The court can reject or give whatever weight it wants to the findings of the magistrate.
Did Judge Conte hear oral argument in this case after the magistrate's report?
No, he did not.
So the thing was never set down on the district court's docket. In the sense of being kind of a petition to review the magistrate's order. I mean, you didn't submit anything to the district court, and he held no hearing.
Well, I will agree with you as far as the timetable is concerned. There was nothing submitted after the magistrate's report. The case was assigned to Judge Conte's docket. I filed a brief with Judge Conte's docket, a 20-page brief that fully outlined our position on the issues of law.
Was this the same brief you gave the magistrate?
Yes. So, I mean, when I file it, it goes to Judge Conte. Judge Conte fills out a little form that sends it to the magistrate. Magistrate sends it back to Judge Conte with the report and recommendation. I would indicate for the record, and I was responding to Justice Brennan, that two of the circuits in this country indicate that where there is no objections, the district court does not even have to review the magistrate's report. There's nothing more for the district court to do in the case. It elevates, in my opinion, a magistrate to a judge. I would reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Aren't you going to argue that the statute forbids this, for heaven's sake?
I thought I had, Your Honor, in the article, in interpreting.
Well, Article 3 would make the statute irrelevant.
Well, in my opinion, the statute says, in read in conjunction, that you may file the magistrates to file a report and recommendations to for final decision by the judge is what the statute says.
Well, isn't one of your arguments that the statute on its face and its legislative history forbids this result?
Yes.
Do you think there's any difference between magistrates' recommendations on factual findings as opposed to points of law? As I understand your argument, it makes no difference which it is, an issue of law or of fact. There's no waiver in your view.
That's correct. I recognize that four of the circuits have held that that a failure to object waives the right to appeal factual findings but not legal conclusions. As Justice Marshall pointed out in his dissent in Raddatz, I believe that Justice Brandeis, and I would agree with him, indicates that in habeas corpus petition, You're entitled to a review of the facts and the law by a judge. And in my opinion, because of the great place that we have for the petitioner habeas corpus in our society and the fact that we're talking about a liberty interest, we really must have a judge, and based upon the statute, which holds that the judge is the ultimate decision maker, the judge must decide everything.
One point. Is your only point the fact that you don't have to file an objection?
Let me make it clear, Justice Marshall. I would dearly have loved to file the objection because then I wouldn't be here having to argue.
Well, that's the only point that's here. You agree?
Yes, yes. In my opinion,
you want us to say that the rule of the circuit is wrong.
That's correct.
Unconstitutional.
In my opinion, yes, based upon the decisions.
What part of the Constitution does it violate?
It violates due process and it violates Article 3 by practice of the policy, which is that you do not have – the
mean,
district court does
– You mean 5 – which one? Which amendments are you talking about?
Amendment 5 and 14, Your Honor.
5 and 14. And that denies you due process.
In my opinion, a magistrate – not having a judge –
Now, what else would you have filed with the court under an objection more than the 20 pages that you filed?
Nothing. To be honest with
you. So what are we complaining about other than that you just don't like filing a piece of paper?
Well, like I said, if I had to do it over again, I would. What I don't – where the law stands now is that it elevates a magistrate to something higher than he should be by allowing him to be the final determination of the issue. The issues were before Judge Conte. He recognized that and he decided them. I said if I had to do it over again, I would file them.
Well, suppose we send it back. Will you file it or not?
You tell me to file them, I'll file them. I'll file them. If it's going to cure the problem that exists and the reason I'm here, I'll file them.
I'm still finding out what's here.
What's here is the question of whether or not the Sixth Circuit's determination in my case that I could not appeal from the district court order is viable. I say to this court that my client has the right to appeal to the Sixth Circuit from the denial by the district court judge of her petition for habeas corpus. They say that not failing to file objections waives that right, and I say that's unconstitutional.
Mr. Stanley, was your failure to file objections intentional or an oversight?
You have to understand, Justice Blackmun, I'm a sole practitioner. Up until Friday when a circuit court judge granted a stay based upon your latest Mitchell versus Wyeth, I was supposed to go back tomorrow to Akron to start a month-long jury trial. I have to put out my time in each case as best I see it. In this case, I had filed a brief. The issues were before the district court judge. I felt to file an objection would have been just simply an exercise in futility. The magistrate considered my petition, my position on the issues, and made his recommendation.
So it was not an oversight?
No. It was simply a matter where I didn't feel that it would add anything to the controversy before Judge Conte by filing objections. It would have been I would have simply refiled my brief that I had already filed.
Mr. Stanley, how is conditioning an appeal in these cases on filing of objections any different than conditioning an appeal on the timely filing of a brief or payment of a filing fee or something of that kind?
Well, I think it's different because, number one, Congress has given a petitioner for a writ of habeas corpus the right to appeal. Number two, Congress
— Well, even so, can't the courts enforce a requirement of filing memos or briefs on a timely basis and so forth?
Certainly.
Well, sure. So why not this?
Well, because this is where a circuit court is saying we're not going to let you appeal because you didn't do something in the district court, namely file objections. Number one, it goes to statutory construction of Congress's intent, which this Court has repeatedly said Congress's intent is for the district court to be the ultimate decision maker, not the magistrate. Number two, the penalty for failure to file objections is quite clear from Congress's intent that you just simply do not get a de novo review. There is no express policy outlined in any of the statutes or any of the legislative history from Congress that they expected a waiver of the right to appeal. I would say to this Court that where you have a petition for habeas corpus and the right to appeal, that the circuit courts cannot limit their own jurisdiction. As I pointed out to Justice Stevens, you now have a mishmash in the different circuits, where in some circuits you can appeal from with even though you have a failure to file objections, and in other circuits you can't. And I think that's untenable.
Mr. Drake.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the issue in this case is whether a federal circuit court may condition appellate review upon the filing of objections to the report and recommendation of a federal magistrate.
Mr. Drake, the way you state the question interests me. You're not contending, then, that there's a statutory requirement that circuit courts take this view?
No.
So you're saying it's a matter each circuit can adopt its own rule?
Yes, and I'm saying that the Sixth Circuit has adopted, and under its supervisory powers, the
a permissible rule that is not required by statute.
A rule which is not only permissible, but fosters congressional intent. I don't believe that the Magistrates Act actually speaks directly to this question. The question is whether the Sixth Circuit may do this, not whether it's compelled to do so.
And therefore, it also follows, I guess, that it's not a jurisdictional rule.
Oh, it is definitely not a jurisdictional
rule. Because they didn't make it retroactive, so obviously they thought they had jurisdiction to go either way.
They made it prospective only to accommodate what I feel they perceive to be potential due process difficulties.
Well, do you think that is their rule limited to the cases where the defendant gets notice?
Absolutely.
And is that your position also?
Yes.
That if he doesn't get notice, there can be no waiver?
The rule was promulgated in a case, United States versus Walters, which is cited in the brief. The rule was not even utilized in that case. It was made prospective only from the date of that decision.
But it is you don't push for any wider
no.
waiver rule.
No, Your Honor. I don't believe that the statute compels it for force, no.
So I take it in the answer to Justice Stevens that other circuits could have just the contrary rule.
Circuits could, if in their wisdom, I believe, though, if you look to the congressional intent underlying the Magistrates Act, a circuit who declines to adopt the Sixth Circuit rule is essentially, for reasons unknown to me, fostering upon itself review.
But it would be permissible, you think?
It would be permissible.
You don't urge us then to try to make the rule uniform or not?
I think that if affirmance is given in this case, we might have more circuits adopting this rule in their own self-interest. As I pointed out in the brief, the difficulty is not uniform to all the circuits. For instance, the District of Columbia Circuit apparently has very little difficulty, if you look at the statistics, whereas the 4th, 5th, 6th, and now the 11th Circuit have considerable difficulty.
At least there is a question as to whether this was a proper exercise of the supervisory power.
I believe that's the only question before.
And Congress did indicate what a penalty for failure to file was, or is.
As to the district court, yes.
Yes. Why should a court impose a further penalty for failure to file?
Because the purpose underlying the Magistrates Act, and it's had a checkered history, the original 1968 version encountered a series of adverse judicial decisions, including ones from this court. And it was in response to your invitation and that of the Chief Justice that the 1976 amendments were actually enacted. The theory underlying the 1976 amendments very much parallels the master system used in the United Kingdom or the referee system used in most states today, which is to use non-Article III jurists, here magistrates, to delineate the scope of the dispute. Oft times you'll have in a civil case a multi-count complaint filed. The magistrate might recommend summary judgment as to, let's say, 18 of those, and the litigant will then have essentially, the magistrate will serve as a filtration system where the litigant will then make an intelligent judgment as to whether or not he wants to proceed. That is the entire theory underlying this, that the magistrates will filter this litigation in the non-dispositive context. The review is under the clearly erroneous standard. In the dispositive context, as I said, the Magistrates Act did not fare well in the courts. They were very, very aware of Article III difficulties, and they made it absolutely clear that if the litigant so desired, he could obtain, he had the opportunity to obtain review anew. But he could forfeit that opportunity. This case is tantamount, in my opinion, simply to a failure to prosecute or any other procedural default.
Suppose the page paper that he filed, suppose the first page of it said, I object for the following reasons.
In other words, you're saying, suppose the objections would have been filed, Your Honor?
Suppose he said, quote, I object for the following reasons, end of quote. That's all he put on the top of the 20-page thing he filed. Would that be satisfactory?
You mean initially, when he initiated this litigation, Your Honor?
Yes.
No, Your Honor, I don't.
Didn't he file something in the district court?
He never did. Your Honor, I think there's a misstatement or misunderstanding here. He never, after the magistrate issued the report and recommendation, the only thing he filed was a motion for extension of time. He never refiled anything in the district court, anything of any
kind. Where is this 20-page thing he's talking about?
When he filled out the form, the habeas corpus form, which is provided for in the rules, and he also attached thereto a brief reiterating the claims he had made in the state
court. You mean that was a filing before the magistrate?
That was referred to the magistrate, yes.
That was referred to the magistrate?
Yes, and considered by the magistrate in conjunction with the briefs filed by the state of Ohio and a very voluminous transcript.
What did he file with the district court?
With the clerk's office when he initiated this action.
Well, I the district court means the clerk's office,
right.
I assume.
He filed the petition and a brief in conjunction therewith. That's all he ever filed except for the motion for extension of time.
And after the magistrate ruled, he didn't file anything else?
Except for a motion for extension of time, he filed nothing.
He filed nothing?
Nothing. Surprisingly, he didn't even file a 59E motion to alter amend judgment, which probably would have avoided this question also, at least many circuits have held. It wasn't too late even when the judgment was issued, in my opinion. But
well, why wouldn't it be too late then? Under the Sixth Circuit rule, it seems to me if you don't file.
Well, the Sixth Circuit has never really addressed the issue.
Well, but as far as we know, the Sixth Circuit rule seems to be an inflexible rule if you don't file objections.
No, Your Honor, first of all, the Sixth Circuit rule is not inflexible at all. As I pointed out in the brief, there was a pro se litigant, and the Sixth Circuit found in that instance that there was cause for the failure to the procedural default and wanted to avoid a manifest injustice. The rule is not inflexible, and we are not talking about jurists who are unreasonable.
Let me just go back for a second to Justice Marshall's question. If after the magistrate's ruling, your opponent had filed a piece of paper which said, I object to the magistrate's rulings for the reasons stated in the memorandum I filed originally, period. That would have been enough, wouldn't it?
The Sixth Circuit has never addressed it. What you're talking about is in any published decision in any event, what you're talking about is the pro forma blanket objection. I don't know. I can't answer your question. I don't know if they would hold an attorney at law.
Pro forma because they would have filed that he would have spelled out his argument. Well, I see what you're pointing out.
I think that in the case of a pro se applicant, that would be sufficient. He's doing the best he can. Here we're talking about someone who's admitted to the bar. And in point of fact, Mr. Stanley had filed four claims. When he went to the Sixth Circuit, he abandoned three of those. Here we have a district judge who, sua sponte, took it upon himself to unnecessarily waste time on three claims, which obviously he had intended to abandon anyway. The Act would have worked in this instance. He would have filed objections, in theory, on only one of the four claims, and Judge Connie, who at that time had been elevated to the circuit court, would not have had to deal with 75% of this litigation, Your Honor. And that is what the Sixth Circuit is trying to do, not take away someone's right to appeal, but merely mandate that they perfect that right to appeal. And not — here we have not only a failure to file objections, but in the Sixth Circuit, Mr. Stanley did not so much as file a reply brief indicating why he hadn't filed the objections, even though our brief dealt at length and initially with this question. Mr. Stanley did not appear at the oral argument. The circuit court below had neither written nor oral explanation as to why these objections were not filed.
Mr. Drake, what about a situation when the district court, sua sponte, alters the finding or recommendation of the magistrate on, for example, a point of law, and no objections had been filed in a timely basis, but the district court on its own reaches some legal conclusion different from the magistrate's recommendation? Would there have to be a right to appeal from that?
For instance, Your Honor, are you indicating perhaps Judge Connie would have granted the writ as to one of these claims?
Yes.
Had Judge Connie granted the writ as to one of these claims, and I here have to speculate to some degree because it's never really arisen in the Sixth Circuit, but it would be my judgment that the State of Ohio could appeal that Mr. Stanley could appeal raising as the sole ground for affirmance. That relied upon the district court and could neither file a cross appeal nor could he rely upon the other three grounds that were not considered by Judge Condi. I think that would be the logical extension of what the Sixth Circuit is saying.
And if a circuit nevertheless tried to apply the waiver rule, would there be anything in the statutory scheme or the Constitution to prevent it?
If the Sixth Circuit, in the case where the writ is granted,
yes,
tried to
enforce a waiver.
I can't imagine myself ever making that argument, and I don't think the Sixth Circuit could do that.
Well, but is there anything in the statutes or the Constitution that would prohibit a circuit from having so stringent a rule of waiver?
It would prohibit it? Nothing would come to mind except for general concepts of fairness, Your Honor. I can't imagine a circuit court ever doing that. I'm unaware of any remotely analogous situation.
How specific do you think the notice must be?
I think
here it was quite specific.
I think the notice
has to. What if it weren't? What if it were a general notice?
I think
that you might lose your right to appeal.
Some circuit courts have had difficulty with this, and I think that the Sixth Circuit has taken the wiser course and mandated that the notice be so specific that any child who really can read or write at all would understand that notice. Here we're talking about some people that are in prison but aren't that educated, and I'm certain that if you can read at all, you understand what that notice means. It's not ambivalent or ambiguous to any extent whatsoever. And I think Mr. Stanley's contrary assertion is sheer sophistry, Your Honor. That's a very explicit notice. And it's even in capital letters, as you can see at page 50 of the joint appendix.
Well, if there were no notice or if the rule did not allow an appeal in the other circumstance I suggested, would that raise due process concerns then, in your view?
If there were no notice, yes. For instance, if in the United States versus Walters itself, had the Sixth Circuit promulgated a supervisory rule, and in that case it would have taken away the government's right to appeal, as it turns out, but it had gone the other way. I do see due process concerns. I think that notice is absolutely essential.
Do you think that each individual attorney has to be advised by the government or by somebody, by the court, of their right to appeal from a judgment of the district court to the court of appeals?
No, Your Honor. For instance, had there been a rule, any rule of appellate procedure is not obviously incorporated in every order of a court. Attorneys are deemed to be on notice and are, to some degree, pro se litigants, are deemed to be on notice of rules that are longstanding. This court doesn't, for instance, send me rules of practice every time I come here. But I think that the rule, it's the wiser course because we are
but
here.
I thought you were saying it was constitutionally.
No, I think notice is constitutionally mandated. The fact that you actually put it in every pleading, which is what happens in the Sixth Circuit, every report and recommendation.
Yes, but I thought your answer to Justice O'Connor's question was that if there weren't that sort of notice, there would be real constitutional implications. I wonder how you square that with the fact that nobody gets any notice other than reading the statute of their right to appeal from the district court to the court of appeals.
Your Honor, I meant that, for instance, if a circuit court came up with some supervisory rule that took litigants by surprise and made it retroactive to appeals which were pending, I would have some difficulty.
You're talking about kind of a judge-made rule.
Right, which is what we have here is essentially a rule which the Sixth Circuit perceives, and I agree, is very congruent with the intents underlying the Magistrates Act. You simply cannot have your Article III district judge being bypassed and sandbagged. The idea is to serve some sort of a filtration system. Congress certainly did not mean to aid Article III district judges and to the detriment of Article III circuit court judges.
Well, but, of course, Judge Condi doesn't seem to have taken advantage of the latitude which you say Congress gave him.
He did not take full advantage of the latitude which Congress gave him. Perhaps that might — I have no idea why Judge Condi did what he did. He certainly was not incumbent upon him to do so.
Maybe he enjoys reviewing magistrates' decisions.
I honestly do not know, obviously, Your Honor, why he did what he did.
Well, you certainly wouldn't need to reach any constitutional argument if notice weren't provided by the court rule. All you'd have to say or hold here is it was an improvident
exercise of the supervisory power not to require notice. You wouldn't need to reach any constitutional issue.
I would agree. But here, notice, express notice was given, Your Honor. Mr. Stanley acknowledges that he got the notice. The fact that he filed the motion for extension of time, which was granted, is indicative of that fact. There's no dispute that the only dispute is his belated misinterpretation of what that fairly plain language meant, Your Honor. But once again, I would point out that we are here dealing with a court who has decided to exercise its supervisory power. Reversal can only obtain if that supervisory power is repugnant either to the Constitution or a statute. Mr. Stanley has pointed out no repugnancy that I can ascertain. He simply disagrees with the wisdom of the supervisory rule. Here, I believe that, and I believe the statistics indicate, that there should be some latitude here for the various circuits to operate in the manner that they wish to operate, absent some repugnancy to an overriding statute or the Constitution. And no one has said that this rule is mandated nationwide. Some circuits, particularly the Eighth Circuit, obviously doesn't perceive the need to have such a rule. If they want to allow district judges to be bypassed, Congress has indicated that they can do so, I believe. I believe, though, if the court below is affirmed, perhaps circuit courts will feel a little more latitude and be a little more receptive to the Sixth Circuit rule. What Mr. Stanley is attempting to do is relieve himself of the obligation as an officer of the court to apprise the court of the fact that he is dissatisfied with a portion of the magistrate's report, or for that matter, the whole thing. And he's putting the onus on the judiciary to do his job, as is precisely what the circuit courts have said. We are not going to allow this to happen. This is no different than any other legitimate procedural requisite, as Justice O'Connor said, to file a brief, to file a timely notice of appeal, to appear at a pretrial conference, to give discovery. Essentially, what we have here is a failure to prosecute. And we have a totally unexcused failure to prosecute. I have no idea.
May I interrupt for just a second?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is it your view or the view in the Sixth Circuit that a district judge acts improperly if, when there are no objections to the magistrate's report or file, the district judge decides on his own initiative to review the whole report and decide whether he agrees or disagrees with it?
I don't know what the Sixth Circuit view on that would be, Your Honor. What Judge Conte did in this case is highly unusual, though, as a matter of common practice.
The effect of the rule, as I understand it, though, really doesn't have anything to do with what the district judge may do. He can still either review or not review his own election,
yes,
which is what Congress seems to be thinking about mostly. The whole force of this rule is to protect the Court of Appeals,
That's right.
I understand it, from reviewing cases where there was a procedural default before the magistrate. And it's irrelevant what the district court does.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Even if the district court writes a great long opinion, they'll say, we won't bother reading the opinion because of the failure in the magistrate level.
I don't believe that they would say in each and every instance some inflexible.
Well, it's the general rule would be.
Yes. If you could
but this rule does nothing to protect the district judge, as I understand it.
No, the district judge is, in point of fact, what really happens is the district judge ordinarily does not do what Judge Conte did here. But the rule is not designed to protect him. I doubt if it could.
But the judge is free to do it if he has a new magistrate he's not confident or something like that. He can take a good
hard
look.
If the judge, for instance, got a new group of law clerks and wants to let them practice and he wants to review these magistrates' reports, he certainly is privileged to do so. And I would have grave problems if the circuit court told him he couldn't do that.
But the only time the judge is really required to give de novo review is if there's an objection.
Yes.
And if the objection only goes to part of the report, that's all he has to give de novo review on.
Which, and this is a classic case, Your Honor, there's only one complaint before this court on the merits, and there were four originally. Presumably, Mr. Stanley would have objected only as to this battered wife syndrome question, abandoned the other three claims, with a considerable savings of time in the long run to judges like Judge Conte. Judges should not be presumed to be forced or compelled to do what Mr. Stanley wants when the litigants are not before him complaining.
But may I interrupt once more? If I understand your position correctly, say there's the district judge thought there was merit to one of the four claims to which no objection had been made. The district judge would have the power to grant relief.
Yes.
But the Court of Appeals would not. If the district judge denied relief, the failure to object would deny the Court of Appeals the power to grant relief if they enforce this rule just automatically.
Once again, Your Honor, I don't believe it's been erected as an inflexible jurisdiction.
No, I understand. But as
barrier.
A general rule, the Court of Appeals said, well, we don't have to look at this appeal because there's this failure here. Affirmed. Whereas the district judge doesn't have to do that.
You might well have a proffer here that Mr. Stanley was in the hospital, that he was ill, that
the district judge just might have been extremely conscientious in deciding he wants to take a good hard look at it. But the Court of Appeals would just say we don't have jurisdiction because they didn't follow this rule.
Absent at least a proffer of cause and an indication of you might even have, at least in the judgment of one of the judges below, some indication of manifest injustice because he thought there was some merit. I disagree with him as to that point. But it's the two prongs here that was not so much as a proffer. Your Honor, the motion for rehearing, which was the first instance.
No, but there was a proffer in the Court of Appeals, because in the Court of Appeals they said, look, there is a meritorious point here. And the Court of Appeals said, we're not going to listen to your argument because you failed to object before the magistrate.
But Mr. Stanley never gave a proffer as to why he failed to do this.
Well, he didn't explain his failure to object. I understand that.
In a motion for rehearing, Your Honor, he said, and I'm quoting, counsel is the one who screwed up. That's a quote, and did not elaborate. Your Honor, that does not, to me, equate with cause here. I mean, this entire case is to alleviate one individual in a habeas corpus action from exercising his duties as an officer of the court, and we're in the United States Supreme Court. This is not an onerous burden put on counsel, Your Honor, in my opinion, and particularly...
Nobody's suggesting it is. Yeah. The point is, what is the power of the Court of Appeals when this set of facts develops? The district court is free to look at it, as I understand.
Correct.
Court of Appeals is not. As a normal practice.
I don't think that the Court of Appeals is saying that the district court can't look at it, Your Honor, if I understand your question. They're saying that in what we consider to be this sort of a sandbagging scenario, we will not transfer ourselves into essentially the first Article III court that reviews the substance of these claims. And as my brief points out, the circuits which have adopted this rule are the circuits which are inundated with precisely these kinds of cases, because certain circuits, for instance, the District of Columbia doesn't have that many prisoner petitions, I presuppose, at least according to the statistics, whereas the 5th, the 11th, the 4th, and the 6th do. And again, I'm not asking for some nationwide rule of uniformity. I'm simply making it the point that I believe that the Sixth Circuit has taken the wiser course. And even if it's not the wiser course, it's not one that's repugnant to the statute or the United States Constitution.
Well, Mr. Drake, the Sixth Circuit, as I understood it, acknowledged that it had jurisdiction of an appeal, but it dismissed it for failure to make the objection below, just as it might refuse to entertain an appeal on other issues that aren't raised below.
Your Honor, for procedural default,
isn't that right?
Yes. As a matter of fact, Engle versus Isaac arose out of the Sixth Circuit. They had jurisdiction to hear those claims, but because of the procedural default, they could not do it, essentially. It's not the power to review. Here we're talking about the supervisory rule, which is only given after this express notice. And the rarity of these cases is demonstrated by this case, I believe. I mean, you do not see a flood of instances where the Sixth Circuit has to invoke this rule, even against pro se litigants. And as I've indicated, it's not an inflexible barrier, jurisdictional otherwise, because they have at least in one reported decision granted leave to review those merits when there was a proffer of cause and a feeling that there had been an injustice by the magistrate's ruling, Your Honor. Are there any further questions?
Very well.
Thank you.
Do you have any further, Mr. Stanley?
Just briefly.
First of all, regarding Justice O'Connor's statements, the Sixth Circuit's rule is not a procedural default rule. There's only one circuit, the Fourth Circuit, that calls a procedural default. The Attorney General may be trying to translate it into that. The Sixth Circuit says, under our supervisory power, you have to file objections or you waive your right to appeal. If it was procedural default, that would be an order of the court, and then that should apply presumably around the country. Here we have, if you're going to talk procedural default, and four of the circuits, it doesn't matter, and in two of the circuits, it does. That doesn't make any sense. Justice Marshall, in your question...
But you don't say it's a jurisdictional rule, do you?
In my opinion, form over substance, it's a jurisdictional rule. You cannot appeal because you didn't file objections. It's not procedural default. It's a jurisdictional rule. It's a jurisdictional prerequisite, is the way the Sixth Circuit put it in one of its unpublished opinions. And in talking about the differences between the magistrate and the judge has the case from the beginning. He never loses jurisdiction over it. It doesn't go from the judge to the magistrate and that somehow they're two different people. The magistrate's working under the judge. The judge has the ultimate determination. The brief that was filed presented the issues. That's what we're talking about in this case. Were the issues, gut reaction, were the issues before the trial judge, before the district court? Yes, they were. I filed a memorandum, extensive memorandum of law. This case has been argued extensively and briefed extensively between, and this is the sixth court I've been to for relief for my client. Now, there simply cannot be a waiver construed from that. As I said before, I'm sorry I didn't file the objections because then we wouldn't have to be here. But the fact of the matter is the issues were before the district court. And the district court made the de novo determination. Congress has given us the right to appeal from a denial of habeas corpus. And the Sixth Circuit, in their rule, is trying to take away that right, which I don't think it has anything to do with.
Mr. Stanley, did you address the waiver issue before the Court of Appeals?
No, it was never addressed. And I might say that I was ill on the day of oral argument. And after consultation with his predecessor from the Attorney General, was agreed that we could waive oral argument.
Well, you did not raise the waiver rule issue in your brief.
I didn't. They did. There was never any reply brief filed.
You filed no reply brief.
No.
And you agreed not to argue the case orally.
Because I was
sick on
that
CA6 had never heard this argument.
Pardon?
The Court of Appeals has never heard this argument.
I filed the petition then for rehearing, making this argument, and they denied it, and that's what brings us to this court.
A petition for rehearing?
Yes, petition for rehearing from their denial. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in...